We're going to continue our look at 2 Thessalonians 2. The paragraph actually is relatively long, runs from verse 1 to 12. It's all talking about the issues that are introduced in verse 1. The Lord Jesus Christ's coming and our gathering together to him. And in our study last time, we saw that the issue that Paul is addressing in the entire paragraph is an issue that is raised by a conflict created by the teaching that the rapture is an imminent event and the false teaching that the day of the Lord has already begun. He says in verses 1 and 2 that our gathering together to him and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ as being a compromised issue that can shake a person's composure and disturb them, as to the effect that the day of the Lord has come. It's already here. And the only way that that can be a problem, in my understanding of it, is if Paul had taught them that our gathering together with Christ was not going to be simultaneous to the coming of the day of the Lord. Otherwise, it wouldn't upset them at all. If the rapture was going to be included in the events of the day of the Lord, the fact that the day of the Lord had already come wouldn't upset them at all. It wouldn't be right, but it wouldn't upset them. So somewhere in the mix, Paul expected the Thessalonians from 1 Thessalonians 4 to understand that when he says, we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will not go before them who have, you know, been put to sleep by Jesus. He expected them to draw the conclusion from that we who are alive and remain puts forth the potential of an imminent event can happen in our lifetime. Now, there are indications in some of Paul's last writings, 2 Timothy, for example. He said, the time of my departure is at hand. I expect to be martyred, poured out as a drink offering. So he wasn't expecting that the coming of the Lord was going to interrupt that. So there's that. But nonetheless, I really do believe that the issues in verses 1 and 2 are issues of conflict because he taught them about our gathering together to him in 1 Thessalonians. And then somebody either wrote a spurious letter or presented a different doctrine in the church or something that basically said the day of the Lord has already come. So the main implication of the false teaching is that the darkness period of the day of the Lord will be visited upon believers. It's already come. We're not out of here. That means the darkness period of the day of the Lord, which is the outpouring of the wrath, is going to come upon us as believers. And that would upset most people. The problem is that that undercuts the believer's hope and unsettles both their minds and their souls, according to verse 2. And that makes it impossible for them to relate to God by faith, because you can't relate to him by faith while you're not believing him, or you're believing something that's not true about him. Since that's the case, anything that undercuts faith also undercuts God's plan for the individuals who are constantly being called, according to 1 Thessalonians, to trust him day after day after day, because that's how, in the course of 24/7 events and summons constantly, are you going to trust me in this or not? That's how he works out his program with his saints to get them ready for the kingdom that he's going to bring about once Jesus does come back to this earth. So what we're going to do this evening is to start looking at verses 3 and following, because he's going to actually talk about our gathering together to him and the coming of the Lord. The day of the Lord. He's going to actually deal with that issue, and that's where verse 3 begins. So I want us to think about, to start with, it says in verse 3, let no one in any way deceive you, for, and then it says, it will not come in italics, because that's not, Paul left that out. He just was thinking faster than he was writing, and he assumed that they'd understand. He literally said, for, unless hey, apostasia comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every god, or so-called god, an object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as God. He's saying, except that those things happen, then you can't say that the day of the Lord has already begun. And there are a lot of things in this text there are many issues that are floating, and the first one is the gravity of the conflict of doctrine in verses 1 and 2, because he considers the statement that the day of the Lord has already begun to be deadly. It will shake their composure and disturb them. So, he's declaring by that the conflict in these two teachings has the potential to undercut the faith that has to be alive and vital in order for believers to properly relate to God. And that's, I mean, John says in 1 John, if we have the right hope, we will respond the right way. If we don't have the right hope, obviously we won't. So, Paul and John were together on the fact that if you can undercut a believer's hope, then obviously you can undercut the vitality of his response and relationship to God, because the servant that says, "My Lord tarries," became an unfaithful servant. But everyone who has this hope upon him purifieth himself. So those are the issues. In our day, 2,000 years after Paul wrote this, give or take a decade or few, in our day, this declaration that the day of the Lord has come, or that the gathering together, our gathering together to Christ in conflict with the day of the Lord, the whole idea that the rapture is going to come before the day of the Lord starts is flatly denied. They don't even make any bones about the fact that there's a huge block of Christendom that doesn't even believe that there's going to be a great tribulation period or an apocalypse or however you want. They don't even give it a thought. Huge block of visible Christendom just point blankly says you can't understand the book of Revelation. No point in reading it. So all of the stuff that's in the book of the Revelation is just dismissed. And then there's a whole block of another segment of Christendom that just says, well, you know, we're going to live our lives. The world's going to get better and better until finally Jesus is going to come back and he's going to call all men to judgment and then he's going to set up an eternal kingdom and that'll be the end of that. Obviously, that means that we're living in days where this whole issue of the living hope of the believer has been dismissed, tossed out the window. It's a minor issue. I was even told this past week that a preacher told a friend of mine, you know, I'm really saddened that we're divided by such a minor issue. So, there you go. So, Paul's thesis is that a living faith has to have a living hope. If the hope's not there, the faith will, it'll be diluted at best and destroyed at worst. So, then there's the words in chapter 2, verse 3, themselves. He says, let no one in any way deceive you. The word that's translated deceive is pretty potent, because not only does it mean to lead somebody entirely astray, it has a prefix on the front of it, which intensifies it. And then, when we look at the way that it's used in the New Testament, it's a deception that leads to significant disaster. Romans 7:11 says, using this term, that the law was given and sin took it and through it deceived me and by it killed me. So in Romans 7:11, deception led straight to death. And in 2 Corinthians 11:3, Paul talks about the corruption that's in the world. And it's caused by this deception. So there's an enormous amount of importance associated with this idea of being deceived with this particular word. In other words, there's some things that are at stake here. And if you don't get them right, if you're deceived by some kind of something, then it'll have a real bad effect. And then when he says in verse 3, let no one according to any standard of any method deceive you. In other words, the deception will run according to some pattern. They'll either say, well, it's not that big of a deal, or no, the Bible doesn't teach that, or you've misunderstood the words, or whatever. Whatever means, he says, don't let anybody in any way deceive you. So any manner of argument that establishes the lie that the day of the Lord has come and therefore the gathering, our gathering together to him is not going to deliver us from the dark period of the day of the Lord. Anything that makes that the scenario is one of the ways that we're not supposed to be deceived. Because, as we've already said, the phrase, the day of the Lord, is a phrase that uses the biblical concept of day, not in terms of its duration, days in terms of hours, but it's a dark period followed by a light period. And it can be, if you get exactly the right day of the year, you can have an equal period of dark and light. But every other day of the year is either more dark than it is light, or it's more light than it is dark. And yet we still call it a day, because it's, our thinking is 24 hours. It's really, though, a rotation. And we start with the dark if we're Jews, and then we end with the day. Well, that's the idea. And for the day of the Lord to start with the dark period, and for believers to be subject to the dark period, means that Jesus is not, according to 1 Thessalonians 1:10, delivering us from the coming wrath. Because the coming wrath is the dark period of the day. And if the day has already started, if the darkness has already settled in, the day has already started, we're still here, we're still being subjected to the events that are going to happen in this world, then we're going to be subjected to the coming wrath, because that day is called a period of wrath. It's the outpouring of the wrath of God that's been stored up now for 6,000 years. So, it's really a bad deal for a person to think that he's going to be subject to the wrath of God, even though he's believed in Christ and expected to be gathered together to him. There are two, as far as I can understand, the deceptions that have gained ground in our day. One of them is actually found in my translation here. It says, "Let no one in any way deceive you, for," and then understood, "it won't come, the day of the Lord won't come, unless the apostasy comes first." Now, that's the New American Standard, copyright in 1979. I found out this morning that the New American Standard, copyrighted in 1995, doesn't read like this one does. We were going over some stuff in 1 Thessalonians last night in Georgetown, and the 1979 New American Standard uses the word bereft, and then it uses the word thwarted. "We were bereft of you for a short time, only in body, not in mind or in spirit. But Satan has thwarted us multiple times," as I've tried to get back to you. And their New American Standards, which were published in 1995, copyrighted in 1995, they use the word abandoned something. It doesn't use the word bereft. Is that a King James word? No, that's a New American Standard. That's not my New American Standard. And then the word thwarted is used hindered. They've switched it to the hindered. So I said, well, I guess I need to get a new American Standard. Because they're changing the words. They do that. I mean, editorial upgrades. But nonetheless, the issue here is that in the King James it says, unless a falling away comes first. And then the New American Standard in this translation says the apostasy comes first. And the problem is that we need to understand the words "the apostasy" in a different way than has popularly been promoted. The popular idea of apostasy is what? Doctrinal error. You've abandoned something that you once believed was true. You've apostatized from that. And that's our typical understanding of apostasy. So when the translators say "the apostasy," there is a very strong inclination to think that they're talking about some kind of departure from the faith. And lo and behold, Paul tells Timothy in his last letter to him, "In the latter days, the Spirit expressly says that the days will be evil and men will be lovers of themselves rather than lovers of God, and there will be no natural affection," and on and on and on. So from that, a lot of people have said, well, you know, Paul taught a latter-day apostasy, and this letter is saying that the day of the Lord won't come until that latter-day apostasy comes first. that's the word translated the apostasy. That's what they say it means. I don't believe that's what it means. I think one of the most popular deceptions that have gained ground in our day for people who actively believe in the rapture, even premillennially, they believe that this is a reference to a latter-day departure from the faith at the end of the age of the church. And that's why they translated it the apostasy. I think the second most popular deception that's gained ground in our day is the notion that I already mentioned, that we really ought not to have any kind of strength of conviction about timing issues because it's such a minor thing. I mean, why would you want to argue about when the rapture is going to happen or not? That's the attitude. Well, if the rapture is not going to happen until after the day of the Lord has started, you've got a huge problem, I think, because we were promised that Jesus was coming to deliver us from the coming wrath. And unless we take that coming wrath to be that general judgment at the end of all of human history, like the reformers do, reform theology, unless we take that to mean the coming wrath, we've got a problem. We're in the dark period of the day of the Lord. That's the period of wrath. I think that's a big problem. But anyway, I think it's delusional to say that whatever Paul had to say in 1st, 2nd Thessalonians is really a minor doctrinal difference. We can get along and still agree to disagree about it because it's such a minor thing. But Paul said point blankly in verse 3, don't let anyone with any method deceive you. So that means we need to zero in on exactly what did he say and what did he mean by what he said. And so let's just start with what's got to happen before the day of the Lord can begin. He says that there are two things in verse 3 that have to happen before you can say that the day of the Lord has come. The day of the Lord has come in verse 2 is a lie. That's not true. It's false teaching. And his rebuttal of that is that day can't come until the apostasia occurs and the lawless man is revealed. Those two things have to happen. And so what we're going to do is we're going to look at those issues this evening so that we can understand exactly what he was saying. I think the first issue is the statement, unless apostasia comes first. What does apostasia mean? Well, we have a burden in our language because apostasia is translated the apostasy, and it's easy for anybody that hears that to recognize that apostasy in English is a transliteration from the Greek word apostasia. It's a transliteration. Well, the difference between a transliteration and a translation is that when you're trying to translate, you're trying to give an equivalent word in one language for a word in another language so that you can actually give the meaning of the word in the language that's being translated in the language that you're translating to. So you say, Greek says erkomai. That's Greek, erkomai. In English you say, I am coming. Why do you say I'm coming? Because that's what erkomai means. That's a translation. But when you run into a word in Greek that doesn't have an equivalent in English, what they often did was they didn't try to come up with an equivalent. They just transliterated it. Classic is the word baptize. There's no English word for baptize before you have baptizo and the need for a translation of what does baptizo mean. And instead of giving you the meaning, they just give you the word in the same sounds, baptizo, and they just leave it up to the preacher, the teacher, or whoever to give you the content. And that's the problem with transliterations. They just make the translation easier on the translator, but it doesn't do anything for the understanding of the person who's trying to get a grip on what does this mean. So when you have a transliteration, on the one hand, you have to recognize that the transliteration exists because the translation was impossible because the English didn't have the exact equivalent. Exact equivalent. And that's easy to recognize. If you take Liddell Scott down off the thing and flip over to apostasia, you discover this real long article. It's probably more than a whole column of 6-point or 8-point stuff, very small print on a 4-column big page. So it's got a lot of possibilities involved. It's interesting that the first definition of the Del Scott gives to the word apostasia is rebellion. Now, if you're talking about rebellion in terms of a religious doctrine, obviously, a rebellion against a doctrine would be, if you formally did believe it, you would be rejecting it. You would be rebelling against it. That's a possibility, but the word was used in the secular world without religious connotations, so an apostasia was a rebellion. So if a person was a member of he was a citizen of a certain country under a certain government, and all of a sudden he began to try to overthrow that government or whatever, he would be called an apostate. He's rebelling. That's what it would mean in a cultural setting like that. It's interesting, though, that in dictionaries, it's typical that the lexicographers or the writers of the dictionaries, they typically put the most predominant meaning first, and then they order the meanings down from there. So if you find a definition that's all the way down at the bottom, it's probably only not real common that you'll find it meaning that. So the first one would be the most obvious or the most prevalent. Rebellion. You know what the second one is? Disappearance or departure. So, my issue here is that Liddell Scott gives as its second defining possible meaning a disappearance. The disappearance. It's got the definite article in front of it. Or the departure. And that immediately means something in terms of our study. Because if you're going to have a disappearance or a departure that is not a but the, in other words, that's not going to happen unless this happens, the departure, the disappearance comes first, then you've got to ask yourself, okay, what in the context of Paul's interaction with the Thessalonians would give us any sense at all of either a rebellion or a departure or a disappearance? Where in 1 Thessalonians or 2 Thessalonians, up to this point, has Paul said anything about a rebellion or a departure or a disappearance? Now, there is this that you have to recognize, that verse 5 says, "Do you not remember while I was with you, I was telling you these things?" But that's no help when it comes to the disappearance or the departure or the rebellion, because we don't know what he told them when he was with them. But his focus is on the man of lawlessness. The lawless man will be revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Don't you remember that while I was with you, I was telling you these things, and you know now what restrains him, so that in his time he may be revealed. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work, only he who now restrains will until he's taken out of the way, and then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is accordant with the activity of Satan with all power and signs and false wonders. The overwhelming implication is, when I was with you, I had a little mini prophecy conference with you, and I told you what was coming. Okay, in regard to the lawless man, the man of lawlessness, or the man of sin, as I think the King James translates it, the son of destruction. So there is the possibility that Paul made some comments, taught them some things verbally that he didn't mention in 1 Thessalonians or in 2 Thessalonians. But in 1 Thessalonians, he says, "Now I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep." Which means that chapter 4, 1 Thessalonians, verses 13 through 18, he did not talk about when he was with them. Or he wouldn't have said, "Now I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren." Or he would have said, "Now I want to remind you, brethren, what I told you while I was with you about those that fall asleep in Jesus." He didn't. He treated the rapture as something that he hadn't told them. He had talked about the coming of the Lord for them. He had talked about our gathering together to him, but he hadn't talked about how that applies to people who don't survive until he does it. In other words, those who have been put to sleep by Jesus. He didn't address that particular issue. So, having said all that, I believe that what we have in verse 3 is a statement, the apostasia has to come before the day of the Lord can be said to have come. It has to come before that. The question is, what is there in Paul's interaction with the Thessalonians that would be identifiable as the disappearance, the departure, the rebellion? Well, nothing that he said in 1 Thessalonians or first part of 2 Thessalonians had anything to do with any kind of rebellion. I don't remember studying rebellion when we were in 1 Thessalonians. So that leaves us with either a departure or a disappearance, meaning, since they use both those to define it in the second way, that they mean the same thing, that the departure is a disappearance, the disappearance is a departure. Well, to me, 1 Thessalonians 4 is the departure. It is the disappearance. And therefore, he can use the word the apostasia as a reference back to a thing that he talked about when certain of us would disappear or certain things would suddenly disappear. And the only doctrine we have about a disappearance or a departure is the rapture. I mean, you're here. The dead in Christ have now died. You're wondering, okay, we've been told that Jesus is coming for us before the day of wrath starts. We've been waiting for him to come. It's been weeks now. Been months now. He hadn't come yet. But this person who believed Paul's gospel when he came the same time I did, he had an accident the other day and got killed. What happens to him? That's 1 Thessalonians 4. I don't want you to be ignorant concerning those who have fallen asleep in regard to the coming of the Lord for us. Now, it's obvious that if 1 Thessalonians 4 is the doctrine of the disappearance, it has to deal with a disappearance, which in the text is the dead in Christ will rise first, and then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them. Now, we don't know whether he included in his verbal teaching of them or whatever the information that's in 1 Corinthians. But the letter to the Corinthians wasn't nearly as late as the letter to 2 Timothy, the letter of 2 Timothy. So I really think it's a stretch to reach way over to the last letter Paul wrote and reach for a teaching of a latter-day departure from the faith and pull it all the way back into 2 Thessalonians and say this is what Paul was talking about, because you have absolutely no indication that that's what he's talking about. The Thessalonians wouldn't have known anything about a latter-day departure from anything that he had written in this text anywhere. And we don't know that he ever said anything about that. So I think that it's a big mistake to translate it with the English word apostasy simply because it's too prejudicial. I think that we have to look at the phrase, the apostasia that has to come first, and what we've been told already. We were told in chapter 1, verse 10 of 1 Thessalonians that the Thessalonians expected Jesus to deliver them from the coming wrath. The issue of the coming wrath is the question, this question. Is Paul talking about the coming day of the wrath of God, which we know as the 70th week of Daniel, or the Great Tribulation, or any number of those kinds of terms? We talk about the tribulation. Was he talking about that as the day of wrath, or was he talking about it in the sense that the Reformers talked about it as the final day of judgment, when God is going to finally call us all to account? We're all going to stand before this great throne, and God's going to call us to account. And if we're judged to be qualified for the kingdom, he'll separate us out, and then he'll judge everybody by their works, both the believers and the unbelievers. And the believers will go into his kingdom according to their works, and the unbelievers will go into their places in hell according to their works. That's the idea of a day of wrath as a final end judgment period. But that's completely contradictory to the general issues of the New Testament as well as all of Daniel's prophecies. The prophecies of Daniel and the New Testament are that there's this huge plan of God that's in gear and it's going to run. And the church age wasn't included, but there, this law, man of lawlessness was. Daniel taught that this man of sin was going to claim to be above all the gods. And he wasn't going to honor any god. He was going to set himself up as God. And Paul goes into those details right in verses 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And then later, John comes back in the book of the Revelation and fills in some of the details, but nonetheless, Paul has already established those details in this letter. So I believe that it's a mistake to say that the coming wrath is some kind of a final end judgment, final judgment at the end of the period where everybody gets their final eternal thing. I think the day of wrath is, according to the general biblical concept, of a day in which God is going to visit his wrath upon the inhabitants of the earth for all of their wickedness. And that's what the time of Jacob's trouble is all about. It's the time of the tribulation. So, in summary, verse 3 is saying the day of the Lord will not come until the departure comes first. And as far as I'm concerned, that's as clear as it can get, that it's pre-tribulational rapture. There may be a flaw in my thinking somewhere along that line, but so far, all I've seen is the flaws of the people who just skip over the concept. The day of the Lord starts with a period of darkness. You're subjecting the people of God to the period of darkness as if they're subject to the wrath of God. And Paul said in chapter 1 and verse 10, the first letter, Jesus is delivering us from that. And secondly, I think that a problem with identifying the apostasy as a latter-day apostasy from the faith is no real help at all in relation to solving the problem of verse 2. Because the idea of a latter-day period of departure from the faith is so generic in its sense that you can never know when that's going to be. You can't tell. As soon as Paul left Galatia, there was a departure from the faith. The church has always been subjected to this temptation to depart from the faith. There are a whole host of reformers in the Reformation who argued that the Roman Catholic expression of Christianity departed from the faith before the first century was over, and there was a huge departure from the faith from then until Constantine became the ruler and declared Christianity the national religion of Rome. And then even it got worse after that. And so Martin Luther and guys like him who said, you know, the Roman church has been teaching salvation by works from the very beginning. And so what is this doctrine of a latter-day departure in terms of any help at all in relation to trying to identify whether the day of the Lord has come or not? I don't think there's any help there at all. So for Paul to say, look, I want to clarify this issue so that you won't be disturbed or deceived in any way. And the first thing I'm going to tell you is that there's going to be a departure that has to come first. And then you ask yourself, well, what departure did he ever discuss? And the only one you can find is in 1 Thessalonians 4. In this letter. I mean, this is the context where you have to understand what the Thessalonians, how they would understand what Paul meant, and that meant he had to have told them something. So I really believe that the context is determinative. The context is 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and 1st Thessalonians 4 has an extended paragraph on a disappearance that's going to happen, and it will deliver us from the wrath of God that's coming. So that's the first thing that we look for the statement, the day of the Lord has come. The second thing that we have to look for is, he says, this man of lawlessness has to be revealed. He goes on with a lot of descriptions about the man of the lawless man, or the man of the lawlessness, in verses, last part of verse 3, the son of destruction, all of verse 4, and then verse 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. That has a lot of information about this man of sin, or the man of lawlessness. But what he is saying here is that the day of the Lord can't come until this man is revealed. And that raises this question. What did the Thessalonians know of Paul's teaching about the man of lawlessness who was coming? Well, that's where he says in verse 5, don't you remember while I was with you, I was telling you these things? And you know what restrains him now so that in his time he may be revealed? Because the mystery of lawlessness is already at work, but there is a restrainer who will be taken out of the way. And then the lawless one, will be revealed. So the issue of the revelation of the man of lawlessness is the key question. And the question we have to ask is, what will be the revealing issue of the man of the lawlessness, the lawless man? How would the Thessalonians recognize the man of sin or the man of lawlessness? What's going to be the revelation of him? Well, in the paragraph, he says he will be revealed in his time, verse 6. He says he won't be revealed until the restrainer's taken out of the way, and then he will be revealed. And in verse 9, his coming is according to the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, with all deception of wickedness for those who perish, and so on. There's a lot of information in this long paragraph about the revelation of this man of lawlessness. Now, if we take off from the fact that Paul actually told them about this guy who was going to oppose all the gods, and he was going to set himself up as an object of worship so that he takes a seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as God, that's Daniel. The prophecies of Daniel are very clear that there's a little horn in the fourth empire that will do those very things. And so we have to assume, based on the fact that Paul says, when I was with you, I told you this, and the fact that it's very clear in the book of Daniel that this guy has been declared to be of this sort of character. And the question is, what reveals him? And the answer is in Daniel. In Daniel, the revelation of the man of sin was going to be an event that took place that would start the 70th week of Daniel, which is the outpouring of the period of the wrath of God. And that event was a signing of a covenant of peace with the many. And then the clock would start ticking, and there would be 2,520 days from that point until Jesus' feet came back and landed on the Mount of Olives. So the revelation of the man of sin is going to be, you'll know the man of sin's been revealed when there is a covenant of peace and safety. That's what 1 Thessalonians 5 said. When they're saying peace and safety, then sudden destruction will come upon them in the darkness of the day of the Lord. That's what's going to happen when they say peace and safety. Well, what will enable them to say peace and safety? Apparently, it will be the signing of a covenant of peace with those who are going to be saying peace and safety by somebody who has enough political and military clout in the world to guarantee peace and safety to them. And biblically, from Daniel's teaching, that's going to be a latter-day political, military leader of a significant empire, who will be able to dictate to the world what's going to be and what's not going to be, and he'll be able to guarantee to Israel their peace and their security. And when they buy into that and sign a covenant with him, the 70th week will start ticking off. And in the midst of that week, he'll break the covenant himself, and he will defile the temple of God, just like Antiochus Epiphanes did. So, I really believe that there are two events that have to take place, according to verse 3, in order for the day of the Lord to actually start. One of them is the disappearance has to happen, and the other one is the man of sin has to sign a covenant, a peace covenant, where he guarantees peace and security to the people of Israel. Once those two things happen, the clock is ticking and you can say the day of the Lord has come. So, what kind of questions or observations does that raise?